Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Sawbones, a Merrill tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Sydney, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Justin.
It's our show.
Yeah.
I'm not really technically welcoming you to it, I guess.
How are you doing, Justin?
I'm well. How are you? Because you don't look super happy.
Well, Justin, I'm not going to lie to you. This is going to be maybe a rough one.
Okay.
Okay. So as many of you probably are already aware, it's Pride Month.
Right.
And which is a month that we celebrate, well, we should every month, but a month to really focus on how we should celebrate the LGBTQ community. And I think that that's a time for a lot of happiness and joy, but it's also important for us to remember the history of the persecution of the LGBTQ community, especially in this country. And to kind of go through as a medical professional, not my personal role in that, but my profession's role throughout that history, specifically focusing on kind of the origins and the current incarnation of what we would think of as conversion or reparative therapy. So I think that that merits not just one, but two episodes, because there's a lot to talk about. And I think it's important for us to talk about, because only by understanding this stuff are we going to be able to stop it, since it's still going on. So if that is something that may be triggering for you, this episode and actually the one we'll record next may be ones that you want to skip.
We have a wide variety of other offerings. We encourage you to check out our putting weird holes in your body department just upstairs. It's lovely. But, okay, so I'm ready, and I'm going to have lots of jokes, so don't worry. They just probably won't be related to the topic at hand.
That's
but I'll
fair.
Try this, to...
You know, it fits into the Sawbones theme of really ridiculous, misguided stuff that was done in medical history. It's just, it's harder since this is also incredibly harmful and horrific and just terrible.
And with that said, let's get going.
So first of all, thank you to everybody who suggested this topic. Jennifer and Kimberly and Mike and Sarah sent us emails. And then I know we've gotten a lot of tweets and Facebook posts and things suggesting that for a long time that we should do this, but specifically right now. So
we should also address at the top, like, and maybe this might have some thing to do with the reason we haven't covered the topic before, is that Sydney and I are both like straight people, and we're I think we had some trepidation about taking on a topic like this, because, you know, we don't necessarily want to tell another community story, but we also don't want to not tell it. So we are doing our best as straight people to communicate this
exactly
to y'all, and I hope you'll be hope we do justice to it.
We'll do our best. So as we know, sexuality and sexual preference, as well as gender for that matter, is a spectrum and always has been. And same-sex relationships have been observed throughout human history, and not just human history, in many other facets of the animal kingdom. And we know this, and we've known this for a long time, and we understood it and accepted it as perfectly fine until we didn't. And in the second episode, I'll get into more like kind of the religious roots of that. But for now, let's just accept that there was a period of human history where this was fine. And then We decided it wasn't. And what started was kind of the criminalization of the practice. Before we get into the medical aspects, we first just criminalized any kind of sexual intercourse that wasn't basically heterosexual, vaginal, penetrative sex.
All the positions, I'm assuming, were still okay?
Depending on where you were.
Yeah, the state by state, it varies.
Yeah, yeah, really. Decriminalization of same-sex intercourse probably didn't really start until post-revolutionary France. Of course it was France.
France.
I love you, France. Where it was just kind of conveniently left out, like after the Napoleonic era. Just kind of, they didn't talk about it in the law anymore. But the real interest in the subject of, do we need to do anything about same-sex relationships? Is there something to say about it other than, I mean, what had been said so far was, which was just either put these people in jail or in horrible cases, let's kill these people. What else could we say about it? And this really came into play in the late 19th century as we were beginning to spend a lot more time talking about mental illness. So this was the first time where we began to understand that maybe sometimes people committed crimes related to an underlying psychiatric illness that would make them unable to make what we would consider, you know, basic right and wrong decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that somebody would be unfit to stand trial is just blossoming.
Okay.
And under that umbrella came same-sex relationships, LGBTQ. This was a good thing in the sense that
I don't mean to shock the world with unorthodox views.
No,
of sexuality.
I don't have those views. What I mean,
Sawbones grinds to a halt as world shudders at surprisingly. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
This seemed like a good thing initially because it moved these relationships out of the realm of the criminal world and into the psychologist's office, right? All of a sudden we have doctors who are saying, well, this isn't, you know, deviant, maybe this is a disorder.
Okay.
And so we need to do something about it. There were a lot of many German psychologists, a lot of this thinking came out of Germany, who were kind of setting the idea that maybe what they called it sexual inversion was some kind of genetic trait, and they would refer to it as some sort of psychosexual hermaphroditism. Where it wasn't an anatomical hermaphroditism, it was a psychosexual one, and so you were drawn to express the what they considered the opposite gender traits, very stereotypically speaking, and so then you would display these other sexual tendencies, and there were a lot of progressive thinkers in Germany who were actually saying, you know what, this is probably fine, this is probably just a variant that we're not recognizing, like some people do this. Other people do the other thing. It's no big deal. It's probably fine. Obviously, that was a minority view at the time.
Sure.
And that challenged the predominant belief among a lot of physicians in the 1920s that same-sex attraction was some kind of birth defect.
Mm.
That it was just something that, I mean, maybe you could cure medically or maybe you couldn't, but you were born with, but it was a defect. Physicians were concerned about it, but they really didn't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
And until Viennese endocrinologist Eugen Steinek attempted a procedure where he took the testicles from a male guinea pig and transplanted them into a female guinea pig. And then he began to record results that the female guinea pig began demonstrating some what were thought of as traditionally male characteristics like mounting behavior and things like that. So from that, he started to posit the theory that maybe these traditional sexual behaviors and stemming from that gender roles came from testicles.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Take a shot in the dark. Why not?
So maybe we could fix it with surgery.
Maybe it was just a boss female guinea pig who knows what she wants and wants it now. You know what I mean? Maybe it had nothing, wasn't even testicle related at all.
Well, I think you're seeing a lot of assumption that it is simply a testicle that makes a man or simply testosterone that makes a man when obviously we know that things are a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah. Also, please remember that as we judge this person, and rightly we should, also remember that they had to go home and look their spouse or significant other in the face and tell them what they did that day. And a lot of days, That was cut the balls out of guinea pigs. So that's like their whole, and put them in other guinea pigs. And that was like their whole day also. Now, but okay, back to judging them.
Now, okay. And I think it's very fair that we judge him for this. He did a lot of other things in endocrinology that were actually really good medical advances. I'm not going to get into that though, because what he did next was he partnered with a surgeon to transplant testicles from straight men into gay men to try to fix them.
You messed up. You don't get to be in history anymore.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry.
The results were subjective. They basically, after it was over, the two doctors went, it was a success. It's great. They're very masculine now. They're over there grunting and burping and scratching themselves. Total success. Just trust us. Don't masculine. Talk to them or anything.
Yeah.
But it was great.
Don't ask them who they'd enjoy having sex with, for sure. Because that one, we haven't worked out the kinks of. But it seems to be going well other than that.
No, actually, this was not a success. Even though initially they thought there was some hope for it. Their human body rejects things that aren't tissue compatible. So there was rejection of these testicular transplants. And these were huge medical problems. And so it was a complete failure. And obviously should never have been attempted to begin with. So nobody was convinced by that. Nobody thought that was the way to go. So some, like Freud plays a role in this story. Sigmund Freud. Mm-hmm. In case, I don't know if there's another Freud that anybody ever just refers to as Freud. But there you go. Began to believe that since it was a mental illness, maybe this is treatable not really by some sort of surgery or medication, but by therapy, you know, psychoanalysis, especially hypnosis. He was a big fan of hypnosis. And initially, he kind of promoted this idea, made it popular among a lot of other psychiatrists and psychologists, which was very harmful, of course, because he was Freud. His ideas were thought to be very grand and influenced many people. But he later changed his mind about it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he later said that he thought, you know what, same-sex attraction is probably fine. And generally, most of us are born bisexual anyway. Hmm. And we really don't develop a defined sexual orientation until puberty. And he did tie same-sex attraction to certain, what he would think of as like childhood traumatic events or repressions or those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But he basically said that you can be well-adjusted and be gay, and it's fine. And he stated that as far back as 1935. He's not only did he say it's not a disorder, but he said you shouldn't try to treat it, mainly because you can't. Mm-hmm. There's actually a really famous letter he wrote to a patient's mother who wrote him first and said, please cure my son. And she described her son, and he writes back this letter and says, I take it from your letter that your concern is that your son is gay. He wouldn't have used that word at the time. He would have said homosexual. I believe you think your son is homosexual, and let me tell you, this is fine, you know, and there's nothing I can do about it, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. So let it go.
Fixed. The end. Okay. Freud has spoken, folks. That's going to do it for us here on Sawbones.
Now, this was not the final word. You know, even his daughter, I don't really talk much about her in here, but even Freud's daughter, who was a famous psychoanalyst as well, she actually kind of said, you know what, we really shouldn't use that letter as what he truly believed, because she went on to practice like hypnosis and therapy to try to fix. I'm using that with air quotes, fix gay people.
Yeah, we're using a lot of air quotes. Well, yeah. The fingers are flying here, folks. Yeah. Just assume. If you think it sounds like we should be using them, we probably are.
The conservative American culture that followed World War II changed any of this kind of progressive thinking that maybe was starting to happen. Any of these thinkers who were saying, you know, maybe this is fine, maybe we were wrong to criminalize this, maybe we should embrace everybody. We got this very kind of stereotypical definition of gender roles in this country after the war. The family unit was supposed to be a man and a woman and whatever, 2.5 children and a dog and a white picket fence. And, you know, traditional gender roles were strictly enforced and society was very rigid. And all of the psychoanalysts and psychiatrists and psychologists and all these people who came of age in this era came into this atmosphere as well and followed these same beliefs and applied them to sexual orientation. So many psychiatrists in the 1950s and 1960s felt that any, you know, same-sex attraction ran contrary to the natural order of things. And they saw Freud as kind of a pessimist. He just didn't know how to fix it, so he said it can't be fixed. But not because it isn't a problem, just because he wasn't smart enough to figure it out. They thought they were smart enough to figure it out. So you start to see these psychiatrists. One was Samuel Haddon, who was a psychiatrist in Pennsylvania, who began bringing groups of gay men together who were seeking conversion. People who, because of the oppressive society they were living in, felt that they were wrong inherently as people. And they began to seek out these doctors to help them. And the psychiatrist would bring them together to like share and interpret each other's dreams, talk about their feelings and what he considered their neuroses. And he talked about how over time they would begin to cast aside their flamboyant clothes and mannerisms, and they would get married to women.
Done.
And there you go.
You start with the clothes. Day one.
Start with the clothes.
All your cool clothes that look rad, and all of you look fantastic. Please take those off.
And go get married to a woman.
Go get married to a woman. That's step two. It doesn't matter which woman, guys. That's the way it works over here for straight people. We just pick the first one we see and go for it.
There were other psychiatrists who joined this kind of belief that if we just talk to people, you know, we could kind of account for the whatever caused them to be gay. That there was that thought that something in their past, something in their psychological history would give you a clue as to what caused this. And then you could, you know, quote-unquote, fix it. So psychiatrists Socarides and Bieber, not that Bieber, a different Bieber.
Different Bieber.
I have no...
Maybe a distant relative?
I have no reason to think that. I knew you were going to say that.
Get at me, Biebs. Let's talk it out.
But they spoke out prominently in the media. So these psychiatrists were being interviewed, and this was being published in newspapers and magazines, that same-sex attraction is just this maladjustment that's born of childhood trauma, and we can correct it. We can fix it. It might take a while, but you send somebody to a psychiatrist, and it takes a long time, but eventually we will fix it. And so you see these people. I actually read this really emotional account from one man who sought out a psychiatrist to try to help him as a young man, because, I mean, he was desperate. He thought that he was broken. He thought he was wrong. And it's this very complex relationship. Even now he talks about with this psychiatrist who tried to do all this therapy and convert him to a straight man. It never really worked. He was always unhappy. And today the psychiatrist has apologized and said, well, everything I did was terrible and I'm so sorry and I can't believe I did this harmful thing and I've ruined your life and I'm the worst person on earth. And it's this really complex relationship because this patient says, you know, yeah, it was wrong, but like I asked you to and I wanted you to and society made me think that this and, you know, I have this close relationship, so I don't hate you for it, even though it was this terrible thing that was being done. And I don't know, you get all these really complex accounts of this kind of period, because a lot of this right now is just talking. A lot of what we're talking about at first was just sitting with somebody and talking. And then a lot of, oh, I have to mention that there was a neurologist at this point who said that you could cure it by riding a bicycle for a long time.
Now, I don't understand.
I have to throw that out there.
That doesn't make sense.
No, I don't know how that worked, but a lot of men rode a lot of bicycles for a while, and that was it. They got really well-developed calves. But a lot of terrible things start happening now as we move away from just talking.
Well, normally this is the part where I'd be like, go on, tell me more. I can't wait to hear more, but I don't actually, but we still have to. So let's take a break real quick.
Let's go to the billing department.
Blessed relief of commercialism. Let's go. The medicines that escalate
macabre for the mouth. I think staying connected is really one of the best gifts that you can give during this holiday season. And I think Aura Frames is a really good way of doing that. Here's what you do. It's a digital photo frame. You set it up for the intended recipient, or they can set it up themselves, you know, if they're a little bit more tech savvy. But once that's done, you are able to send pictures onto that photo frame from anywhere wirelessly through the Aura app. So imagine this. You set it up for grandma, and then you capture a picture of the kids at the zoo. Maybe there's five dolphins. You're like, holy crap, grandma loves dolphins. She's going to love this picture. Well, she could be seeing it just by uploading it directly to her frame. Even if grandma's already got one, what if she needs a second one in the toilet? Or it doesn't have to be in there. It could be anywhere. But imagine that. You get beautiful designs from Aura range from, like, I just saw the new Carver mat that it's new to me. I got a new Carver mat frame. It's really beautiful. I like all the designs, and I think you will too. Not just for you, though. Maybe it's a gift. But you know what? Grab one for yourself. You're going to be jealous. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver Matte Frames, named number one by Wirecutter, by using promo code Sawbones at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code Sawbones. This deal is exclusive to listeners and frames sell out fast, so order yours now to get it in time for the holidays. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. You've probably heard about HelloFresh in the past. It's a huge meal kit in America, the number one meal kit in America. But this fall, they're serving up even more love. Folks, this isn't the HelloFresh you remember. It's new. HelloFresh has doubled its menu. Now you can choose from 100 options each week, including new seasonal dishes and recipes from around the world. You can also, if you're into veggies, you can eat greener with some new veggie-packed recipes that have two or more veggies per dish. That's, I gotta say, folks, that's ambitious for me. I think a two-veggie meal, I'd be feeling pretty darn good about myself. I really like this new offering from HelloFresh. All these options, you are definitely going to find some stuff that you love. The best way to cook just got better. Go to HelloFresh.com/Sawbones10FM to get 10 free meals plus a free breakfast for life. One per box with active subscription. Free meals applied as discount on first box. New subscribers only, varies by plan. That's HelloFresh.com/Sawbones10FM to get 10 free meals plus free breakfast for life.
Hi, this is Griffin McElroy.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
And we're the host of Rose Buddies. It's a podcast about the Bachelor family of products.
We watch The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, and Bachelor in Paradise.
Yes, it is garbage television, but we're the king and queen of this garbage pile. We're the raccoons in charge around here.
So join us on Tuesdays.
Because the TV show's on Mondays. And basically we'll recap what we saw, and we'll just sort of scoop the garbage around us and make a little fort out of it.
No viewing required.
But it's a good TV show. What are you doing?
All right, Sid, before I so rudely interrupted you, things were about to get worse.
That's right. So we move on from this era of, you know, kind of the classic, like, Freud, like, psychoanalyst with the leather couch and, you know, kind of telling the story of the relationship with your parents and your dreams and whatnot, to some really aggressive approaches in the psychiatry and psychology world. One was called confrontational therapy. This was developed by Dr. Bergler. This involved basically, the way you would confront your patient was to yell horrible things at them in hopes that they will stop being gay. So call them names, tell them they're worthless, tell them they should die, tell them everybody hates them, tell them that they're broken and they're sick and disgusting, and that the thought was this would foster some shame and guilt, and this would motivate you to change.
So idiotic. I mean, you can't even give these people a pass of like, well, it's a different time, we didn't shut up, because like people who are doing this were seeking out your treatment, like, right? I assume. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah a lot, right? Of these, no one,
they most, a lot of these people weren't being conscripted into it, right? Like,
no, well, there were people who sought this treatment for sure, but you have to understand, and I probably should preface with this, there are many of the things I'm going to talk about that were done to children, adolescents, young men and women whose parents were seeking help for them.
I think our point stands that society at the time was already doing a pretty bang up job of this. Like, right?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, the guy sounds like, man, it's gonna be hard not to curse on this one. Sid, go ahead.
It's almost like at the time, this specifically, Dr. Bergler, was very opposed to the research that had just come out from Dr. Kinsey, who was actually really ahead of his time and progressive when it comes to LGBTQ issues, and basically said this is fine and I don't understand why are we trying to fix this? This is not an illness, and please everybody stop what you're doing, and which was adding a lot of fuel to the fire of the very beginnings of the gay rights movement. And this really made this Bergler guy angry, and his therapies just got worse and worse. And a lot of other therapists and psychiatrists followed suit and came up with increasingly horrible ways of trying to stop people from being gay. So that could include things like electric shock therapy, electric convulsive therapy. You could apply shocks to the hands or the genitals or the head. A lot of this would be accompanied by like having your patient recount a same-sex experience they had or fantasy they had or movie they saw or something mm-hmm. like that as a way of trying to apply a negative stimuli.
Sure.
So that you would be averse to it. Aversion therapy was very popular at this time in general. Castration was attempted. The female genital mutilation was done. Bladder washings were done.
Like a douche?
No.
Okay.
No. That's not a bladder washing.
I'm sorry. I'm not a doctor.
That's okay. No, that's a different orifice.
Okay. Oh, okay. Got
yeah.
it. Yeah, yeah.
Bladder.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Got it. For sure.
Where the pee is.
Super sorry.
Yeah. There were a lot of places, not just in the U.S., this was actually done in the U.K. too, where you would give people drugs, emetics, things that would make you puke after you were exposed to what they would consider like gay materials. So they would show you a picture of a gay couple and then try to induce vomiting to try to connect that reaction to gay behavior.
This is obviously disgusting and hugely troubling. So this whole list has just been the pits. So let's do just a quick sidebar. The way Sydney has that line written in her notes is drugs that would make you puke when exposed to gay materials. And I was sitting here freaking out like, what pill is this? Are you kidding me? There's a pill that makes you puke when exposed to gay materials?
No.
That's impossible, Sydney. That doesn't make sense. I was questioning the authenticity of the entire endeavor.
My outline just has enough words in it that I know what it means.
Okay,
that's
sure.
all it ever knows. That's all it ever means. That's all right. We know, we've talked about it on our lobotomy episode before, that lobotomies were done for all kinds of horrible reasons, and obviously same-sex attraction was among them. Things like strychnine, cocaine. They tried to induce insulin shock in some patients, basically give them so much insulin that they became very hypoglycemic and went into shock. There was a drug called metrazole that has since been removed from the market because it gave people these horrible, like, back-breaking spasms when they took it. It was used for other psychiatric illnesses as well, but this too. And if all that failed, some were advocates of just beating somebody until they agreed not to be gay anymore. Because that's in any way a
has
medical
has ever been
treatment.
Effective treatment for anything.
For anything ever. What helped to turn this tide was really the gay rights movement. I would love to say that these psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists realized what they were doing was absolutely horrific on their own, but it really was outspoken gay rights leaders with the assistance of the minority of social workers and psychiatrists and psychologists who were progressive and forward thinking, who agreed with them, who began to, you know, write the course of history. Things happened like Haddon, the psychiatrist I mentioned earlier, who kind of started the talk therapy, was invited to speak at a rally that was put on by Janus, which was a huge gay rights organization based out of Philadelphia. And basically, once he got there to start talking, they just eviscerated him, shouted him down, and, you know, called him out on every one of his lies and every one of his pieces of data that weren't data and everything. Demonstrations like these that were so prominent and newsworthy led to more people in the medical and, you know, psychology world kind of questioning the prevailing wisdom of the day and beginning to think that maybe we're going about this wrong. Because we're harming, obviously this is causing harm. And if a treatment is doing more harm than good, we need to take a step back and see, is this treatment appropriate and why are we doing it? And have we made the correct diagnosis? And in this case, there is no diagnosis at all. So there was a small group that began to wonder, is there a way to do sexual orientation affirming therapy that would have better results for these patients?
How do you mean?
Meaning to tell people that it's okay to be gay.
Oh, that's a radical idea.
Yeah, that maybe that would be the better way to go. What really helped with this was in 1956, Dr. Evelyn Hooker. So she presented a groundbreaking study that caught the attention of a lot of people in the medical world. She had not set out in her career to kind of stake her claim, make her name, studying, you know, issues related to LGBTQ patients. But early on in her career, she gave a lecture to some of her students where she was working after she had gotten her PhD. And the student came up, one student came up to her after a lecture and said, "Listen, Dr. Hooker, I am gay and I want you to study me. I want you to come with me and meet my other friends who are also, you know, part of the gay lesbian community. And I want you to learn about us and talk with us. And if somebody will study us and show that this is not a problem, that we are happy, healthy, well-adjusted people, just as normal as anyone else, then maybe this will go, you know, maybe this will help. Maybe this science could help show people that they're wrong." So she spent a ton of time hanging out with people that from a community that, by the way, she had like no contact with before. So kind of opening her eyes and interviewing and assessing her new friends. And then she went and applied for a grant, said, "You know what? All these interviews aren't going to mean anything. I need science. I need a grant to do a study. I need a real study with hard data to show people." So she applied for a grant. It was the longest of shots that she was going to get a grant to do a study to prove that gay people are not maladjusted in some way, because that was not the prevailing thought, especially among people in the government who were approving grants.
Right.
But the story is that she was incredibly charming in person, and she went for her interview and just charmed the heck out of the guy, and he eventually agreed to give her the grant. So she got it, and she set up an experiment with 60 men. Half of them were gay and half of them were straight, and she subjected them to a series of psychological evaluations, including, it was this time, a Rorschach test. And the Rorschach test, by the way, was supposed to be like the most sensitive to tell a gay person from a straight person. Yeah, that you could always tell by the Rorschach test.
The Rorschach would give away every time.
So after she had gathered her profiles from all these tests, she submitted them anonymously to three other psychologists. So she just handed them a stack of 60 profiles with no names on them. They don't say whether the subjects were gay or straight, and said, "You need to decide two things. Who's more well-adjusted among all these people, and find the gay men. Who's gay and who's straight?" They couldn't do any of it. They could tell no difference. Of course, we know this. We know this now. There was no difference between the gay men and straight men. You can't tell by psychological evaluation because it's not a psychological problem. And there is no difference in how adjusted or maladjusted they are because it's not a disorder. It's not an illness. Yeah, so she presented this in 1956, and this was explosive.
You know what? I had a temptation. I would say fleeting temptation when we were talking about some of the more monstrous medical practices to try to couch that in the fact that, like, it's, you know, it was science following the lead of society. Science had convinced itself this was an issue. Society was convinced it was an issue, and it was science trying to find a fix. But I think the reason that doesn't fly is that this is where the science should have started. Like, this, mm-hmm. you can't, it is a failure of society aside. Mm-hmm. It is a failure of science that this did not start with, you know, ethnography and
yes,
this sort of study before fixing it, quote unquote, mm-hmm. again, sorry.
No,
was even part of the equation.
You're exactly right. It's unfortunate because that's not the way science works. Science seeks truth no matter how uncomfortable that truth might be for any given person in any time in history. And that was not how the science started. Mm-hmm. The science finally got there. Following this study, this led to more grants, more research. This had a huge impact on the changes to come. And this gave a lot of ammunition when it came to gay rights activists and groups who were able to cite these studies and these findings and say, this is why, you know, politicians and lawmakers, this is why this is wrong. This is why this discrimination is evil and wrong. And then, of course, in 1969, the Stonewall riots drew national attention to the issue and the importance of the medical profession standing up and saying it is not a pathology to be gay. It is not an illness. Mm. This was supported by, in 1969, the Dorian Society of Seattle founded the Dorian Counseling Service for Homosexuals, which was the first counseling center to focus on sexual orientation affirming therapy, meaning that you were going to see a therapist who was going to tell you, listen, I know what society says. They're wrong. You're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. You're not sick. This is just who you are. And it's going to take us maybe a while for everybody to get there. And you might need the support of a therapist to help you deal with society. but you are fine. In 1972, what also helped with this was Dr. John Fryer, who was a psychiatrist who appeared in disguise as Dr. H. Anonymous at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association and sat up on a panel in front of all of his fellow doctors and said, "I am gay and I am a psychiatrist." He was terrified to reveal his identity. He thought he would come under violence and nobody would ever see him again as a doctor and he would lose his license. But the idea that, you know, among their peers were, you know, fellow members of the LGBTQ community and they were being persecuted by their fellow doctors for no good reason, this really moved a lot of the other psychiatrists. So finally, as a result of all this, 1973, homosexuality as a diagnosis is removed from the DSM-2, which is like the psychiatry Bible of diagnoses. It's where they list all the different, you know, kinds of different psychiatric illnesses and diagnoses. But hidden in the somewhat in the diagnosis that they added was ego dystonic homosexuality. So initially in 1973, they take that out. That's a huge landmark moment. But they put in this diagnosis of ego dystonic homosexuality, which means you're gay and we're fine with that. We don't have a problem. That's not a problem. But you're really depressed about it. And we think that's a problem. And so we want to diagnose you with this. But this was still like a weapon used against the LGBTQ community because it still put the problem, the diagnosis was on the person instead of society.
Well, yeah, because broadly, it's not a diagnosis because broadly speaking, you're talking about a country and a time when it was still incredibly hostile to homosexual people.
Exactly. So this is not a real diagnosis. This is again, putting the blame on the victim instead of on society.
Right.
And this diagnosis was used as a weapon for a long time in conversion therapy. It was removed from the DSM because of this in 1987, but it does still remain in the World Health Organization International Classification of Diseases. You can still find this as a diagnosis.
Hmm.
In 2013, the DSM-5, the next iteration of this, added gender dysphoria, which still exists. And while that's a whole other topic, not really the topic of this show, this is really similar in regard to gender as ego dystonic homosexuality was to orientation, because it's basically saying a transgender person who is not happy or comfortable with that, with them being transgender because of society. And so we give them this diagnosis instead of saying, no, the problem is that we have a society that discriminates against transgender individuals. And that's still in there. The short story on all of these efforts to convert gay people is that they lead to depression, anxiety, self-destructive behavior, things like drug abuse, homelessness, and suicide. And also, they don't work at all. Any of this stuff that I just named, it only had negative consequences. And it invariably does not work. And it is rejected by the medical profession pretty much en masse today.
Well, so we're done here. Gosh, I thought this was going to take 2 weeks, but...
Justin, I wish we were done.
Okay, well, that sounds ominous as all get out, but...
There is another, even as the medical community was finally starting to get its act together... There was another movement that would raise its ugly head and continue these harmful therapies. And we'll talk about that in part 2.
All right. Well, folks, thanks for hanging in there with us. I'm really concerned about this. I just want to make it clear from my perspective. Like, I know that I did jokes and stuff because that's the show we do. And I just really hope we're not experts in this stuff. So we're trying to do our best to say the right things and not do more harm, and we're doing our best. So
right. Well, I know that we've said this before. We avoid topics like this sometimes on the show because our show's supposed to be funny, and there's nothing funny about this, and mm-hmm. we're not pretending that there is. But I do think it's important history, and I think again, if we don't remember and understand where we came from, we are in danger of going back there.
Yeah. And I don't mean to make light of it by doing jokes either. It's just, it's that or scream at the top of your lungs for a half hour. So, you know, it's kind of up to you. It's your choice. That's going to do it for us. Thank you to our sponsors. Thanks to MaximumFun.org for having us on there. This week, I will recommend a new show called Reading Glasses that was just added to the network, and it's about books, which I'm just gaga about them.
I like them too.
You a fan?
Open them up.
So go check out Reading Glasses. The very first episode has Sarah Benacasa on it, and you can go listen to it. So go get it wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Thank you to the taxpayers for the use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. And thanks to you for listening. We will see you next week. But until that time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.